time vault that just missed definition in several directions at once. It was not one of decay, for it was well lit and well conditioned, with the color scheme of the walls lively and the rows of fixed chairs comfortable and apparently designed for eternal use. It was not even ancient, for 3 centuries had left no obvious mark. There was certainly no effort at the creation of awe or reverence, for the appointments were simple and everyday. Next door to bareness, in fact. Yet after all the negatives were added and the sum disposed of, something was left. And that something centered about the glass cubicle that dominated half the room with its clear emptiness. 4 times in 3 centuries, the living simulacrum of Harry Seldon himself had sat there and spoken. 2 times he had spoken to no audience. Through 3 centuries and 9 generations, the old man who had seen the great days of universal empire projected himself, and still he understood more of the galaxy and his great, ultra-great-grandchildren than did those grandchildren themselves. Patiently, that empty cubicle waited. The first to arrive was Mayor Indber III, driving his ceremonial ground car through the hushed and anxious streets. Arriving with him was his own chair, higher than those that belonged there, and wider. It was placed before all the others, and Indber dominated all but the empty glassiness before him. The solemn official at his left bowed a reverent head. "Excellence, arrangements are completed for the widest possible sub-etheric spread for the official announcement by Your Excellence tonight." "Good. Meanwhile, special interplanetary programs concerning the Time Vault are to continue. There will, of course, be no predictions or speculations of any sort on the subject. Does popular reaction continue satisfactory?"
"Excellence, very much so. The vicious rumors prevailing of late have decreased further. Confidence is widespread."
"Good." He gestured the man away and adjusted his elaborate neckpiece to a nicety. It was 20 minutes of noon. A select group of the great props of the mayoralty, the leaders of the great trading organizations, appeared in 1s and 2s with the degree of pomp appropriate to their financial status and place in mayoral favor. Each presented himself to the mayor, received a gracious word or two, took an assigned seat. Somewhere, incongruous among the stilted ceremony of all this, Randu of Haven made his appearance and wormed his way unannounced to the mayor's seat. "Excellence," he muttered and bowed. Indber frowned. "You have not been granted an audience."
"Excellence, I have requested one for a week."
"I regret that the matters of state involved in the appearance of Seldon have—"
"Excellence, I regret them too, but I must ask you to rescind your order that the ships of the independent traders be distributed among the fleets of the Foundation."
Indber had flushed red at the interruption. "This is not the time for discussion."
"Excellence, it is the only time," Randu whispered urgently.
"As representative of the independent trading worlds, I tell you such a move cannot be obeyed. It must be rescinded before Seldon solves our problem for us. Once the emergency is passed, it will be too late to conciliate and our alliance will melt away." Indber stared at Randu coldly. "You realize that I am head of the Foundation Armed Forces. Have I the right to determine military policy, or have I not?"
"Excellence, you have. But some things are inexpedient."
"I recognize no inexpediency. It is dangerous to allow your people separate fleets in this emergency. Divided action plays into the hands of the enemy. We must unite, Ambassador, militarily as well as politically." Randu felt his throat muscles tighten. He omitted the courtesy of the opening title.
"You feel safe now that Seldon will speak, and you move against us. A month ago you were soft and yielding when our ships defeated the mule at Tyrell. I might remind you, sir, that it is the Foundation fleet that has been defeated in open battle 5 times, and that the ships of the independent trading worlds have won your victories for you."
Indber frowned dangerously.
"You are no longer welcome upon Terminus, Ambassador. Your return will be requested this evening. Furthermore, your connection with subversive democratic forces on Terminus will be, and has been, investigated.
Randu replied, When I leave, our ships will go with me. I know nothing of your Democrats. I know only that your Foundation's ships have surrendered to the Mule by the treason of their high officers, not their sailors, democratic or otherwise. I tell you that 20 ships of the Foundation surrendered at Horlagor at the orders of their Rear Admiral when they were unharmed and unbeaten. The Rear Admiral was your own close associate. He presided at the trial of my nephew when he first arrived from Kalgan. It is not the only case we know of, and our ships and men will not be risked under potential traitors.
Indber said, You will be placed under guard upon leaving here.
Randu walked away under the silent stares of the contemptuous coterie of the rulers of Terminus. It was 12:10. Beta and Torin had already arrived. They rose in their back seats and beckoned to Randu as he passed. Randu smiled gently. You are here after all. How did you work it?
Magnifico was our politician, grinned Torin. Indber insists upon his visisonar composition based on the time vault, with himself, no doubt, as hero. Magnifico refused to attend without us, and there was no arguing him out of it. Ebling Meese is with us, or was. He's wandering about somewhere.
Then, with a sudden access of anxious gravity, Why, what's wrong, Uncle? You don't look well.
Randu nodded. I suppose not. We're in for bad times, Torin. When the Mule is disposed of, our turn will come, I'm afraid.
A straight, solemn figure in white approached and greeted them with a stiff bow. Beta's dark eyes smiled as she held out her hand.
Captain Pritcher, are you on space duty, then?
The captain took the hand and bowed lower. Nothing like it. Dr. Meese, I understand, has been instrumental in bringing me here, but it's only temporary. Back to Home Guard tomorrow. What time is it?
It was 12:03. Magnifico was the picture of misery and heart-sick depression, his body curled up in his eternal effort at self-effacement. His long nose was pinched at the nostrils, and his large, down-slanted eyes darted uneasily about. He clutched at Beta's hand, and when she bent down, he whispered, Do you suppose, my lady, that all these great ones were in the audience? Perhaps when I played the visisonar?
Everyone, I'm sure, Beta assured him, and shook him gently. And I'm sure they all think you're the most wonderful player in the galaxy, and that your concert was the greatest ever seen. So you just straighten yourself and sit correctly. We must have dignity.
He smiled feebly at her mock frown and unfolded his long-boned limbs slowly.
It was noon, and the glass cubicle was no longer empty. It was doubtful that anyone had witnessed the appearance. It was a clean break. One moment not there, and the next moment there. In the cubicle was a figure in a wheelchair, old and shrunken, from whose wrinkled face bright eyes shone, and whose voice, as it turned out, was the livest thing about him. A book lay face downward in his lap, and the voice came softly. I am Harry Seldon. He spoke through a silence, thunderous in its intensity. I am Harry Seldon. I do not know if anyone is here at all by mere sense perception, but that is unimportant. I have few fears as yet of a breakdown in the plan. For the first 3 centuries, the percentage probability of non-deviation is 94.2.
He paused to smile, and then said genially, By the way, if any of you are standing, you may sit. If any would like to smoke, please do. I am not here in the flesh. I require no ceremony. Let us take up the problem of the moment, then. For the first time the Foundation has been faced, or perhaps is in the last stages of facing, civil war. Till now, the attacks from without have been adequately beaten off, and inevitably so, according to the strict laws of psychohistory. The attack at present is that of a too undisciplined outer group of the Foundation against the too authoritarian central government. The procedure was necessary, the result obvious. The dignity of the high-born audience was beginning to break. Inber was half out of his chair. Beta leaned forward with troubled eyes. What was the great Selden talking about? She had missed a few of the words. That the compromise worked out is necessary in two respects. The revolt of the independent traders introduces an element of new uncertainty in a government perhaps grown overconfident. The element of striving is restored. Although beaten, a healthy increase of democracy. There were raised voices now. Whispers had ascended the scale of loudness, and the edge of panic was in them. Beta said in Torin's ear, "Why doesn't he talk about the mule? The traitors never revolted." Torin shrugged his shoulders. The seated figure spoke cheerfully across and through the increasing disorganization. A new and firmer coalition government was the necessary and beneficial outcome of the logical civil war forced upon the Foundation. And now only the remnants of the old empire stand in the way of further expansion. And in them, for the next few years at any rate, is no problem. Of course, I cannot reveal the nature of the next prob— In the complete uproar, Selden's lips moved soundlessly. Ebling Meese was next to Randu, face ruddy. He was shouting, "Selden is off his rocker. He's got the wrong crisis. Were your traitors ever planning civil war?" Randu said thinly, "We planned one, yes. We called it off in the face of the mule." "Then the mule is an added feature, unprepared for in Selden's psychohistory. Now what's happened?" In sudden, frozen silence, Beta found the cubicle once again empty. The nuclear glow of the walls was dead, the soft current of conditioned air absent. Somewhere the sound of a shrill siren was rising and falling in the scale, and Randu formed the words with his lips, "Space raid." And Ebling Meese held his wristwatch to his ears and shouted suddenly, "Stopped by the galaxy! Is there a watch in the room that is going?" His voice was a roar. 20 wrists went to 20 ears, and in far less than 20 seconds it was quite certain that none were. "Then," said Meese with a grim and horrible finality, "something has stopped all nuclear power in the time vault. And the mule is attacking." Inber's wail rose high above the noise. "Take your seats. The mule is 50 parsecs distant." "He was," shouted back Meese, "a week ago. Right now, Terminus is being bombarded." Beta felt a deep depression settle softly upon her. She felt its folds tighten close and thick until her breath forced its way only with pain past her tightened throat. The outer noise of a gathering crowd was evident. The doors were thrown open, and a harried figure entered and spoke rapidly to Inber, who had rushed to him. "Excellence," he whispered, "not a vehicle is running in the city. Not a communication line to the outside is open. The 10th Fleet is reported defeated, and the mule's ships are outside the atmosphere. The General Staff..." Inber crumpled and was a collapsed figure of impotence upon the floor. In all that hall, not a voice was raised now. Even the growing crowd without was fearful but silent, and the horror of cold panic hovered dangerously. Inber was raised. Wine was held to his lips. His lips moved before his eyes opened, and the word they formed was, "Surrender." Beta found herself near to crying.
not for sorrow or humiliation, but simply and plainly out of a vast, frightened despair. Ebling Meese plucked at her sleeve. "Come, young lady." She was pulled out of her chair, bodily. "We are leaving," he said, "and take your musician with you." The plump scientist's lips were trembling and colorless.
"Magnifico," said Beta faintly.
The clown shrank in horror. His eyes were glassy.
"The mule," he shrieked. "The mule is coming for me."
He thrashed wildly at her touch. Torin leaned over and brought his fist up sharply. Magnifico slumped into unconsciousness, and Torin carried him out potato sack fashion. The next day, the ugly, battle-black ships of the Mule poured down upon the landing fields of the planet Terminus. The attacking general sped down the empty main street of Terminus City in a foreign-made ground car that ran where a whole city of atomic cars still stood useless. The proclamation of occupation was made 24 hours to the minute after Selden had appeared before the former mighty of the Foundation. Of all the Foundation planets, only the independent traders still stood, and against them the power of the Mule, conqueror of the Foundation, now turned itself. Chapter 19. Start of the Search. The lonely planet Haven, only planet of an only sun of a galactic sector that trailed raggedly off into intergalactic vacuum, was under siege. In a strictly military sense, it was certainly under siege, since no area of space on the galactic side further than 20 parsecs distance was outside range of the Mule's advanced bases. In the 4 months since the shattering fall of the Foundation, Haven's communications had fallen apart like a spiderweb under the razor's edge. The ships of Haven converged inwards upon the homeworld, and only Haven itself was now a fighting base. And in other respects, the siege was even closer, for the shrouds of helplessness and doom had already invaded. Beta plodded her way down the pink-paved aisle past the rows of milky, plastic-topped tables, and found her seat by blind reckoning. She eased on to the high, armless chair, answered half-heard greetings mechanically, rubbed a wearily itching eye with the back of a weary hand, and reached for her menu. She had time to register a violent, mental reaction of distaste to the pronounced presence of various cultured fungus dishes, which were considered high delicacies at Haven, and which her Foundation taste found highly inedible. And then she was aware of the sobbing near her, and looked up. Until then, her notice of Juddy, the plain, snub-nosed, indifferent blonde at the dining unit diagonally across, had been the superficial one of the non-acquaintance. And now Juddy was crying, biting woefully at a moist handkerchief, and choking back sobs until her complexion was blotched with turgid red. Her shapeless, radiation-proof costume was thrown back upon her shoulders, and her transparent face shield had tumbled forward into her dessert, and there remained. Beta joined the three girls who were taking turns at the eternally applied and eternally inefficacious remedies of shoulder padding, hair smoothing, and incoherent murmuring. "What's the matter?" she whispered. One turned to her and shrugged a discreet, "I don't know." Then, feeling the inadequacy of the gesture, she pulled Beta aside. "She's had a hard day, I guess. And she's worried about her husband." "Is he on space patrol?"
"Yes."
Beta reached a friendly hand out to Juddy. "Why don't you go home, Juddy?" Her voice was a cheerfully businesslike intrusion on the soft, flabby inanities that had preceded. Juddy looked up half in resentment.
"I've been out once this week already."
"Then you'll be out twice. If you try to stay on, you know, you'll just be out 3 days next week. So going home now amounts to patriotism." "Any of you girls work in her department?" "Well, then, suppose you take care of her card." "Better go to the washroom first, Juddy, and get the peaches and cream back where it belongs.
Go ahead, chew.
Beta returned to her seat and took up the menu again with a dismal relief. These moods were contagious. One weeping girl would have her entire department in a frenzy these nerve-torn days. She made a distasteful decision, pressed the correct buttons at her elbow, and put the menu back into its niche. The tall, dark girl opposite her was saying, "Isn't much any of us can do except cry, is there?" Her amazingly full lips scarcely moved, and Beta noticed that their ends were carefully touched to exhibit that artificial, just-so half-smile that was the current last word in sophistication. Beta investigated the insinuating thrust contained in the words with lashed eyes and welcomed the diversion of the arrival of her lunch as the tile top of her unit moved inward and the food lifted. She tore the wrappings carefully off her cutlery and handled them gingerly till they cooled. She said, "Can't you think of anything else to do, Hella?" "Oh, yes," said Hella. "I can." She flicked her cigarette with a casual and expert finger motion into the little recess provided, and the tiny flash caught it before it hit shallow bottom. "For instance," and Hella clasped slender, well-kept hands under her chin, "I think we could make a very nice arrangement with the mule and stop all this nonsense. But then I don't have the, facilities to manage to get out of places quickly when the mule takes over." Beta's clear forehead remained clear. Her voice was light and indifferent. "You don't happen to have a brother or husband in the fighting ships, do you?"
"No."
"All the more credit that I see no reason for the sacrifice of the brothers and husbands of others."
"The sacrifice will come the more surely for surrender."
"The Foundation surrendered and is at peace. Our men are away and the galaxy is against us." Beta shrugged and said sweetly, "I'm afraid it is the first of the pair that bothers you." She returned to her vegetable platter and ate it with the clammy realization of the silence about her. No one in earshot had cared to answer Hella's cynicism. She left quickly after stabbing at the button which cleared her dining unit for the next shift's occupant. A new girl, 3 seats away, stage whispered to Hella, "Who was she?" Hella's mobile lips curled in indifference.
"She's our coordinator's niece. Didn't you know that?"
"Yes?" Her eyes sought out the last glimpse of disappearing back.
"What's she doing here?"
"Just an assembly girl."
"Don't you know it's fashionable to be patriotic?
It's all so democratic it makes me wretch." "Now, Hella," said the plump girl to her right, "she's never pulled her uncle on us yet. Why don't you lay off?" Hella ignored her neighbor with a glazed sweep of eyes and lit another cigarette. The new girl was listening to the chatter of the bright-eyed accountant opposite. The words were coming quickly, "And she's supposed to have been in the vault, actually in the vault, you know, when Selden spoke. And they say the mayor was in frothing furies and there were riots and all of that sort of thing, you know. She got away before the mule landed, and they say she had the most thrilling escape. Had to go through the blockade and all, and I do wonder she doesn't write a book about it, these war books being so popular these days, you know. And she was supposed to be on this world of the mules, too. Kalgan, you know, and..." The time bell shrilled and the dining room emptied slowly. The accountant's voice buzzed on, and the new girl interrupted only with the conventional and wide-eyed, "Really?" at appropriate points. The huge cave lights were being shielded group-wise in the gradual descent towards the darkness that meant sleep for the righteous and hard-working when Beta returned home. Torin met her at the door with a slice of buttered bread in his hand. "Where have you been?" he asked, food muffled. Then, more clearly, "I've got a dinner of sorts rassled up. If it isn't much, don't blame me." But she was circling him, wide-eyed.
"Tori, where's your uniform? What are you doing in civvies?"
"Orders, bae. Randu is holed up with Ebling Meese right now, and what it's all about, I don't know."
So, there you have everything.
Am I going?
She moved towards him impulsively. He kissed her before he answered, I believe so. It will probably be dangerous.
What isn't dangerous?
Exactly. Oh, yes, and I've already sent for Magnifico, so he's probably coming too.
You mean his concert at the engine factory will have to be canceled?
Obviously. Beta passed into the next room and sat down to a meal that definitely bore signs of having been rassled up. She cut the sandwiches in two with quick efficiency and said, "That's too bad about the concert. The girls at the factory were looking forward to it. Magnifico, too, for that matter." She shook her head. "He's such a queer thing."
"Stirs your mother complex, Bay. That's what he does. Someday we'll have a baby, and then you'll forget Magnifico."
Beta answered from the depths of her sandwich, "Strikes me that you're all the stirring my mother complex can stand." And then she laid the sandwich down and was gravely serious in a moment.
"Tori."
"Hmm?"
"Tori, I was at City Hall today, at the Bureau of Production. That is why I was so late today."
"What were you doing there?"
"Well," she hesitated uncertainly, "it's been building up. I was getting so I couldn't stand it at the factory. Morale just doesn't exist. The girls go on crying jags for no particular reason. Those who don't get sick become sullen. Even the little mousy types pout. In my particular section, production isn't a quarter what it was when I came, and there isn't a day that we have a full roster of workers."
"All right," said Torin. "Tie in the BFP. What did you do there?"
"Asked a few questions. And it's so, Tori, it's so all over Haven. Dropping production, increasing sedition and disaffection. The bureau chief just shrugged his shoulders after I had sat in the anteroom an hour to see him and only got in because I was the coordinator's niece, and said it was beyond him. Frankly, I don't think he cared."
"Now don't go off base, Bay."
"I don't think he did."
She was strenuously fiery.
"I tell you, there's something wrong. It's that same horrible frustration that hit me in the time vault when Selden deserted us. You felt it yourself."
"Yes, I did."
"Well, it's back," she continued savagely. "And we'll never be able to resist the mule. Even if we had the material, we lack the heart, the spirit, the will. Tori, there's no use fighting."
Beta had never cried in Torin's memory, and she did not cry now. Not really. But Torin laid a light hand on her shoulder and whispered, "Suppose you forget it, baby. I know what you mean.
But there's nothing, yes, there's nothing we can do. Everyone says that, and we just sit and wait for the knife to come down."
She returned to what was left of her sandwich and tea. Quietly, Torin was arranging the beds. It was quite dark outside. Randu, as newly appointed coordinator, in itself a wartime post, of the Confederation of Cities on Haven, had been assigned, at his own request, to an upper room, out of the window of which he could brood over the rooftops and greenery of the city. Now, in the fading of the cave lights, the city receded into the level lack of distinction of the shades. Randu did not care to meditate upon the symbolism. He said to Ebling Mies, whose clear little eyes seemed to have no further interest than the red-filled goblet in his hand, "There's a saying on Haven that when the cave lights go out, it is time for the righteous and hard-working to sleep."
"Do you sleep much lately?"
"No."
"Sorry to call you so late, Mies.
I like the night better somehow these days." "Isn't that strange? The people on Haven condition themselves pretty strictly on the lack of light, meaning sleep. Myself, too. But it's different now."
"You're hiding," said Mies flatly. "You're surrounded by people in the waking period, and you feel their eyes and their hopes on you. You can't stand up under it. In the sleep period,
You're free.
Do you feel it too, then? This miserable sense of defeat?
Ebling Meese nodded slowly. I do. It's a mass psychosis, an unprintable mob panic. Galaxy, Randu, what do you expect? Here you have a whole culture brought up to a blind, blubbering belief that a folk hero of the past has everything all planned out and is taking care of every little piece of their unprintable lives. The thought pattern evoked has religious characteristics, and you know what that means.
Not a bit.
Meese was not enthusiastic about the necessity of explanation. He never was. So he growled, stared at the long cigar he rolled thoughtfully between his fingers, and said, "Characterized by strong faith reactions. Beliefs can't be shaken short of a major shock, in which case a fairly complete mental disruption results. Mild cases, hysteria, morbid sense of insecurity. Advanced cases, madness and suicide." Randu bit at a thumbnail.
"When Selden fails us, in other words, our prop disappears and we've been leaning upon it so long, our muscles are atrophied to where we cannot stand without it."
"That's it. Sort of a clumsy metaphor, but that's it."
"And you, Ebling, what of your own muscles?"
The psychologist filtered a long draft of air through his cigar and let the smoke laze out. "Rusty, but not atrophied. My profession has resulted in just a bit of independent thinking."
"And you see a way out?"
"No, but there must be one. Maybe Selden made no provisions for the mule. Maybe he didn't guarantee our victory. But then neither did he guarantee defeat. He's just out of the game and we're on our own. The mule can be licked."
"How?"
"By the only way anyone can be licked. By attacking in strength at weakness."
"See here, Randu, the mule isn't a Superman. If he is finally defeated, everyone will see that for himself. It's just that he's an unknown, and the legends cluster quickly. He's supposed to be a mutant."
"Well, what of that? A mutant means a Superman to the ignoramuses of humanity." "Nothing of the sort. It's been estimated that several million mutants are born in the galaxy every day. Of the several million, all but 1 or 2% can be detected only by means of microscopes and chemistry. Of the 1 or 2% macromutants, that is, those with mutations detectable to the naked eye or naked mind, all but 1 or 2% are freaks, fit for the amusement centers, the laboratories, and death. Of the few macromutants whose differences are to the good, almost all are harmless curiosities, unusual in some single respect, normal, and often subnormal in most others. You see that, Randu?"
"I do. But what of the mule?"
"Supposing the mule to be a mutant, then, we can assume that he has some attribute, undoubtedly mental, which can be used to conquer worlds. In other respects, he undoubtedly has his shortcomings, which we must locate. He would not be so secretive, so shy of others' eyes, if these shortcomings were not apparent and fatal. If he's a mutant."
"Is there an alternative?"
"There might be. Evidence for mutation rests on Captain Han Pritcher of what used to be Foundation's intelligence. He drew his conclusions from the feeble memories of those who claimed to know the mule, or somebody who might have been the mule, in infancy and early childhood. Pritcher worked on slim pickings there, and what evidence he found might easily have been planted by the mule for his own purposes. For it's certain that the mule has been vastly aided by his reputation as a mutant Superman."
"This is interesting. How long have you thought that?"
"I never thought that, in the sense of believing it. It is merely an alternative to be considered.
For instance, Randu, suppose the mule has discovered a form of radiation capable of depressing mental energy, just as he is in possession of one which depresses nuclear reactions. What then, eh? Could that explain what's hitting us now? And what did hit the Foundation?
Randu seemed immersed in a near wordless gloom. He said, "What of your own researches on the mule's clown?"
And now Ebling Meese hesitated. "Useless as yet. I spoke bravely to the mayor previous to the Foundation's collapse, mainly to keep his courage up, partly to keep my own up as well. But Randu, if my mathematical tools were up to it, then from the clown alone I could analyze the mule completely. Then we would have him. Then we could solve the queer anomalies that have impressed me already.
Such as? Think, man. The mule defeated the navies of the Foundation at will, but he has not once managed to force the much weaker fleets of the independent traders to retreat in open combat. The Foundation fell at a blow. The independent traders hold out against all his strength. He first used extinguishing field upon the nuclear weapons of the independent traders of Nemen. The element of surprise lost them that battle, but they countered the field. He was never able to use it successfully against the independents again. But over and over again, it worked against Foundation forces. It worked on the Foundation itself. Why? With our present knowledge, it is all illogical. So there must be factors of which we are not aware.
Treachery?
That's rattle-pated nonsense, Randu. Unprintable twaddle. There wasn't a man on the Foundation who wasn't sure of victory. Who would betray a certain-to-win side?
Randu stepped to the curved window and stared unseeingly out into the unseeable. He said, "But we're certain to lose now if the mule had 1,000 weaknesses. If he were a network of holes." He did not turn. It was as if the slump of his back, the nervous groping for one another of the hands behind him that spoke. He said, "We escaped easily after the Time Vault episode, Ebling. Others might have escaped as well. A few did. Most did not. The extinguishing field could have been counteracted. It asked ingenuity and a certain amount of labor. All the ships of the Foundation Navy could have flown to Haven or other nearby planets to continue the fight as we did. Not 1% did so. In effect, they deserted to the enemy. The Foundation Underground, upon which most people here seem to rely so heavily, has thus far done nothing of consequence. The mule has been politic enough to promise to safeguard the property and profits of the great traders, and they have gone over to him."
Ebling Meese said stubbornly, "The plutocrats have always been against us."
"They always held the power, too. Listen, Ebling. We have reason to believe that the mule or his tools have already been in contact with powerful men among the independent traders. At least 10 of the 27 trading worlds are known to have gone over to the mule. Perhaps 10 more waver. There are personalities on Haven itself who would not be unhappy over the mule's domination. It's apparently an insurmountable temptation to give up endangered political power, if that will maintain your hold over economic affairs."
"You don't think Haven can fight the mule?"
"I don't think Haven will."
And now Randu turned his troubled face full upon the psychologist. "I think Haven is waiting to surrender. It's what I called you here to tell you. I want you to leave Haven."
Ebling Meese puffed up his plump cheeks in amazement.
"Already?"
Randu felt horribly tired.
"Ebling, you are the Foundation's greatest psychologist. The real master psychologists went out with Selden, but you're the best we have. You are our only chance of defeating the mule. You can't do that here. You'll have to go to what's left of the Empire.
To Trantor?
That's right. What was once the Empire is bare bones today, but something must still be at the center. They've got the records there, Ebling. You may learn more of mathematical psychology, perhaps enough to be able to interpret the clown's mind. He will go with you, of course. Mies responded dryly. I doubt if he'd be willing to, even for fear of the mule, unless your niece went with him. I know that. Torin and Beta are leaving with you for that very reason. And, Ebling, there's another, greater purpose. Harry Seldon founded 2 foundations 3 centuries ago, one at each end of the galaxy. You must find that 2nd foundation.
Chapter 20. Conspirator. The Mayor's Palace, what was once the Mayor's Palace, was a looming smudge in the darkness. The city was quiet under its conquest and curfew, and the hazy milk of the great galactic lens, with here and there a lonely star, dominated the sky of the Foundation. In 3 centuries, the Foundation had grown from a private project of a small group of scientists to a tentacular trade empire sprawling deep into the galaxy, and half a year had flung it from its heights to the status of another conquered province. Captain Han Pritcher refused to grasp that. The city's sullen nighttime quiet, the darkened palace intruder occupied, were symbolic enough, but Captain Han Pritcher, just within the outer gate of the palace, with the tiny nuclear bomb under his tongue, refused to understand. A shape drifted closer. The captain bent his head. The whisper came deathly low. The alarm system is as it always was, Captain. Proceed. It will register nothing. Softly, the captain ducked through the low archway and down the fountain-lined path to what had been Inber's garden. 4 months ago had been the day in the time vault, the fullness of which his memory balked at. Singly and separately, the impressions would come back, unwelcome, mostly at night. Old Seldon speaking his benevolent words that were so shatteringly wrong, the jumbled confusion, Inber with his mayoral costume incongruously bright about his pinched, unconscious face, the frightened crowds gathering quickly, waiting noiselessly for the inevitable word of surrender, the young man, Torin, disappearing out of a side door with the mule's clown dangling over his shoulder, and himself, somehow out of it all afterward, with his car unworkable. Shouldering his way along and through the leaderless mob that was already leaving the city, destination unknown, making blindly for the various rat holes which had once been the headquarters for a democratic underground that for 80 years had been failing and dwindling. And the rat holes were empty. The next day, black alien ships were momentarily visible in the sky, sinking gently into the clustered buildings of the nearby city. Captain Han Pritcher felt an accumulation of helplessness and despair drown him. He started his travels in earnest. In 30 days he had covered nearly 200 miles on foot, changed to the clothing of a worker in the hydroponic factories whose body he found newly dead by the side of the road, grown a fierce beard of russet intensity, and found what was left of the underground. The city was Newton, the district a residential one of one-time elegance, slowly edging towards squalor, the house an undistinguished member of a row, and the man, a small-eyed, big-boned person whose knotted fists bulged through his pockets and whose wiry body remained unbudgingly in the narrow door opening. The captain mumbled, "I come from Mirren." The man returned the gambit grimly. "Mirren is early this year."
The captain said no earlier than last year. But the man did not step aside. He said, "Who are you? Are you Fox? Do you always answer by asking?" The captain took an imperceptibly longer breath and then said calmly, "I am Han Pritchard, captain of the fleet and member of the Democratic Underground Party. Will you let me in?" The fox stepped aside. He said, "My real name is Orim Pally." He held out his hand. The captain took it. The room was well kept, but not lavish. In one corner stood a decorative book film projector, which to the captain's military eyes might easily have been a camouflaged blaster of respectable caliber. The projecting lens covered the doorway, and such could be remotely controlled. The fox followed his bearded guest's eyes and smiled tightly. He said yes, but only in the days of Indber and his lackey-hearted vampires. It wouldn't do much against the mule, eh? Nothing would help against the mule. Are you hungry? The captain's jaw muscles tightened beneath his beard, and he nodded. It'll take a minute if you don't mind waiting. The fox removed cans from a cupboard and placed two before Captain Pritchard. Keep your finger on it and break them when they're hot enough. My heat control unit's out of whack. Things like that remind you there's a war on. Or was on, eh? His quick words had a jovial content, but were said in anything but a jovial tone, and his eyes were coldly thoughtful. He sat down opposite the captain and said, "There'll be nothing but a burn spot left where you're sitting if there's anything about you I don't like. Know that?" The captain did not answer. The cans before him opened at a pressure. The fox said shortly, "Stew?" "Sorry, but the food situation is short." "I know," said the captain. He ate quickly, not looking up. The fox said, "I once saw you. I'm trying to remember, and the beard is definitely out of the picture. I haven't shaved in 30 days. Then, fiercely, "What do you want? I had the correct passwords. I have identification." The other waved a hand. "Oh, I'll grant you Pritchard, all right. But there are plenty who have the passwords and the identifications and the identities who are with the mule. Ever hear of Lavar, eh?" "Yes." "He's with the mule."
"What?"
"Yes. He was the man they called No Surrender." The fox's lips made laughing motions with neither sound nor humor. "Then there's Willig, with the mule. Gar and Noth, with the mule. Why not Pritchard as well, eh? How would I know?" The captain merely shook his head. "But it doesn't matter," said the fox softly. "They must have my name if Noth has gone over. So if you're legitimate, you're in more new danger than I am over our acquaintanceship." The captain had finished eating. He leaned back. "If you have no organization here, where can I find one? The Foundation may have surrendered, but I haven't." "So, you can't wander forever, Captain. Men of the Foundation must have travel permits to move from town to town these days. You know that. Also, identity cards. You have one. Also, all officers of the Old Navy have been requested to report to the nearest occupation headquarters." "That's you, eh?"
"Yes."
The captain's voice was hard. "Do you think I run through fear? I was on Kalgan not long after its fall to the mule. Within a month, not one of the old warlord's officers was at large, because they were the natural military leaders of any revolt. It's always been the Underground's knowledge that no revolution can be successful without the control of at least part of the Navy. The mule evidently knows it, too." The fox nodded thoughtfully. "Logical enough. The mule is thorough. I discarded the uniform as soon as I could. I grew the beard. Afterwards, there may be a chance that others have taken the same action.
Are you married?
My wife is dead. I have no children.
You're hostage immune, then?
Yes.
You want my advice?
If you have any.
I don't know what the mule's policy is or what he intends,
but skilled workers have not been harmed so far. Pay rates have gone up. Production of all sorts of nuclear weapons is booming.
Yes.
Sounds like a continuing offensive.
I don't know.
The mule's a subtle son of a drab, and he may merely be soothing the workers into submission. If Selden couldn't figure him out with all his psycho history, I'm not going to try. But you're wearing work clothes. That suggests something, eh?
I'm not a skilled worker.
You've had a military course in nucleics, haven't you?
Certainly.
That's enough. The Nuclear Field Bearings Incorporated is located here in town. Tell them you've had experience.
The stinkers who used to run the factory for Inber are still running it, for the mule.
They won't ask questions, as long as they need more workers to make their fat hunk. They'll give you an identity card, and you can apply for a room in the corporation's housing district. You might start now.
In that manner, Captain Han Pritcher of the National Fleet became Shieldman Lo Moro of the 45 Shop of Nuclear Field Bearings Incorporated. And from an intelligence agent, he descended the social scale to conspirator, a calling which led him months later to what had been Inber's private garden. In the garden, Captain Pritcher consulted the radometer in the palm of his hand. The inner warning field was still in operation, and he waited. Half an hour remained to the life of the nuclear bomb in his mouth. He rolled it gingerly with his tongue. The radometer died into an ominous darkness, and the captain advanced quickly. So far, matters had progressed well. He reflected objectively that the life of the nuclear bomb was his as well, that its death was his death, and the mule's death. And the grand climacteric of a 4 months private war would be reached, a war that had passed from flight through a Newton factory. For 2 months, Captain Pritcher wore leaden aprons and heavy face shields, till all things military had been frictioned off his outer bearing. He was a laborer who collected his pay, spent his evenings in town, and never discussed politics. For 2 months, he did not see the fox. And then one day, a man stumbled past his bench, and there was a scrap of paper in his pocket. The word fox was on it. He tossed it into the nuclear chamber, where it vanished in a sightless puff, sending the energy output up a millimicrovolt, and turned back to his work. That night, he was at the Fox's home and took a hand in a game of cards with two other men he knew by reputation and one by name and face. Over the cards and the passing and repassing tokens, they spoke. The captain said, "It's a fundamental error. You live in the exploded past. For 80 years, our organization has been waiting for the correct historical moment. We've been blinded by Selden's psychohistory, one of the first propositions of which is that the individual does not count, does not make history, and that complex social and economic factors override him, make a puppet out of him." He adjusted his cards carefully, appraised their value, and said, as he put out a token, "Why not kill the mule?"
"Well, now, what good would that do?" demanded the man at his left, fiercely.
"You see," said the captain, discarding two cards, "that's the attitude. What is one man out of quadrillions? The galaxy won't stop rotating because one man dies. But the mule is not a man. He is a mutant. Already he had upset Selden's plan, and if you'll stop to analyze the implications, it means that he, one man, one mutant, upset all of Selden's psychohistory. If he had never lived, the foundation would not have fallen. If he ceased living, it would not remain
fallen. Come. The Democrats have fought the mayors and the traitors for 80 years by connivory. Let's try assassination.
How?
Interposed the fox with cold, common sense.
The captain said slowly, I've spent 3 months of thought on that with no solution. I came here and had it in 5 minutes.
He glanced briefly at the man whose broad, pink melon of a face smiled from the place at his right.
You were once Mayor Indber's chamberlain. I did not know you were of the underground.
Nor I that you were.
Well, then, in your capacity as chamberlain, you periodically checked the working of the alarm system of the palace.
I did.
And the mule occupies the palace now.
So it has been announced.
Though he is a modest conqueror who makes no speeches, proclamations, nor public appearances of any sort.
That's an old story, and affects nothing. You, my ex-chamberlain, are all we need.
The cards were shown, and the fox collected the stakes. Slowly, he dealt a new hand.
The man who had once been chamberlain picked up his cards, singly.
Sorry, Captain. I checked the alarm system, but it was routine. I know nothing about it.
I expected that. But your mind carries an eidetic memory of the controls if it can be probed deeply enough.
With a psychic probe.
The chamberlain's ruddy face paled suddenly and sagged. The cards in his hand crumpled under sudden fist pressure.
A psychic probe?
You needn't worry, said the captain sharply. I know how to use one. It will not harm you past a few days' weakness. And if it did, it is the chance you take and the price you pay. There are some among us, no doubt, who from the controls of the alarm could determine the wavelength combinations. There are some among us who could manufacture a small bomb under time control, and I myself will carry it to the mule.
The men gathered over the table.
The captain announced, On a given evening, a riot will start in Terminus City in the neighborhood of the palace. No real fighting. Disturbance. Then flight. As long as the palace guard is attracted, or at the very least, distracted. From that day, for a month, the preparations went on, and Captain Han Pritcher of the National Fleet, having become conspirator, descended further in the social scale and became an assassin. Captain Pritcher, assassin, was in the palace itself, and found himself grimly pleased with his psychology. A thorough alarm system outside meant few guards within. In this case, it meant none at all. The floor plan was clear in his mind. He was a blob moving noiselessly up the well-carpeted ramp. At its head, he flattened against the wall and waited. The small closed door of a private room was before him. Behind that door must be the mutant who had beaten the unbeatable. He was early. The bomb had 10 minutes of life in it. 5 of these passed, and still in all the world there was no sound. The mule had 5 minutes to live. So had Captain Pritcher. He stepped forward on sudden impulse. The plot could no longer fail. When the bomb went, the palace would go with it. All the palace. A door between, 10 yards between, was nothing. But he wanted to see the mule as they died together. In a last, insolent gesture, he thundered upon the door. And it opened and let out the blinding light. Captain Pritcher staggered, then caught himself. The solemn man, standing in the center of the small room before a suspended fishbowl, looked up mildly. His uniform was a somber black, and as he tapped the bowl in an absent gesture, it bobbed quickly, and the feather-finned orange and vermilion fish within darted wildly. He said, "Come in, Captain." To the captain's quivering tongue, the little metal globe beneath was swelling ominously. A physical impossibility, the captain knew. But it was in its last minute of life.
The uniformed man said, "You had better spit out the foolish pellet and free yourself for speech. It won't blast." The minute passed, and with a slow, sodden motion, the captain bent his head and dropped the silvery globe.